Our top story this morning, a double homicide in downtown Tampa. Two men were gunned down in the lobby of the Saint building.
Now to our other breaking story. Francis Castle is alive back in Tampa.
Those who do evil to others, the killers, the rapists, psychos, sadists, you'll come to know me well. Frank Castle is dead. Call me the Punisher.
Welcome to Percolated Media's look at the Punisher films.
Well, well, well. This day was bound to come sooner or later, wasn't it?
Part of the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast, full Marvel series.
15 minutes late, you stupid dickhead.
Join Matt.
The finest man I've ever known.
Adam.
I know you.
And Garrett.
Don't mind him. Doesn't think before he talks. Just like his mother.
As they review each film involving the Frank Castle character.
We're really sorry.
From Dolph Lundgren to Ray Stevenson and everything in between.
Go with God.
God's gonna sit this one out.
The three co-hosts break down where the character came from.
This is undignified.
As well as his overall place in the Marvel Universe.
You're sick, you know that, don't you?
And of course, just how they feel about all of Hollywood's attempts to bring the character to screen.
Well, it's definitely not in the plan, but we beat the spread.
This isn't football.
Nah, it's a figure of speech.
So prepare to be punished, podcast listeners.
I ask you a question. What's the reason behind you killing all those guys? There's a limit to revenge.
The Percolated Media Punisher Retrospective begins now.
Let's talk.
The Punisher, 1989. Released, as its name suggests, on October 5th, 1989. ... with an asterisk, which we'll talk about. Budget was $9 million. Box office, $30 million. And this was directed by Mark Goldblatt. Well, after a hiatus, which we kind of had to do when you look at that first slate of beautiful garbage that Marvel put out initially, we're back with the next part of our retrospective, and we're finally doing multiple entries of a particular character. This is Goudreau. I'm joined by, once again, my micro, Mr. Garrett Collins.
What's up, gentlemen? Wow, can't wait to discuss this masterpiece.
And I guess our own detective, Mr. Adam Bunch.
All are punished.
Sure are.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of places we could begin because I think it's actually, I'll start here. I believe it's appropriate that the stars are aligning the way they are with the schedule because we did Howard the Duck, we did Dr. Mordred, and we did Man-Thing. And what the Punisher has in common with all of those is that, once again, despite being Marvel proper, he is not a superhero in almost any capacity. So maybe it's kind of interesting, and like I said, appropriate that he's being lumped in with what we've covered already. But there's so many places we could begin. But we got to go back to our youth. Garrett, you've mentioned you've read comics for certain periods of your time on this planet. Where do you stand with this particular character?
This character, gentlemen, I got to say, the only things I know about it are from the three films we're going to be discussing in the next few weeks. I have no familiarity with this character other than the fact that his first appearance was in one of my favorite characters' books, Spider-Man. I think that's where he debuted. But other than that, I have no idea. I never bought a Punisher comic. But other than that, guys, none. Zero familiarity with it.
Well, we'll certainly talk about his origins, not just the ones in his backstory, but where he comes from in Marvel's history. But Adam, what about you?
So for me, this is a bigger comics reader. And at that time in my youth, it was more Marvel than DC. So I was involved. I knew the Punisher well, but it was also only from his inclusion in other characters' comics. It was him as an antagonist, as quote unquote bad guy, that anti-villain. I was never one that would buy Punisher books specifically. It just wasn't my bag. But yeah, for me, it was always seeing him interact, always seeing him show up. Spider-Man specifically, he seemed to be a nemesis almost, you know, to come and thwart that web-slinger. But it was just, he was always kind of inserted in other people's stuff, and especially when it got into, as though no, those wonderful 90s comics. He was just, he was the attitude era of Marvel Comics for that time.
Now, I will say that I've always found the Punisher to be, in a lot of respect, a problematic character for reasons we'll talk about throughout this retrospective, because they've had three cracks at adapting this character on the big screen. You could argue they've had the most success with what Jon Bernthal has done with the character, both on Daredevil and his own spinoff Netflix show, but that's a conversation for another day. And I never rushed to read Punisher comics in my life, much like Adam, when he showed up in Frank Miller's Daredevil run. That was kind of my big exposure to him, and then some of the other forms of media. But there was a period in time where I was getting back into comics, and I had a friend who, hardcore Punisher fan, of which I am not, and he told me, look, there's this guy named Garth Ennis who's working on Punisher now that I think he really liked those comics. And this was around the turn of the millennium with these comics, when he first started writing The Punisher. Not when I first started reading it. That was years later. But I was like, wow, Garth Ennis, I think, finally has cracked The Punisher, where he made really strong crime stories and kind of didn't hide the issues with the character that, unfortunately, fans, both comics and outside comic fans, have taken inspiration in the worst type of way. And that continued with the Max line, where they kind of made the Punisher in modern day dealing with crimes on a larger scale, you know, post-Iraq war, financial espionage on an Enron level of scale. I think Garth Ennis is to the Punisher in a lot of ways what Frank Miller is to Daredevil. Absolutely. But the Punisher did start as a Spider-Man villain in the 70s. Right after Stan Lee stopped writing Spider-Man, this was when John Romita and company were working on the character. The Punisher was a one-off antagonist. He was literally a hired gun working for the Jackal to take out Spider-Man. And then from there, he would make sporadic appearances here and there, but he didn't have his own book. And it wasn't until he showed up in Frank Miller's Daredevil, where they kind of expanded upon the character. They gave driblets of his backstory, but they never really fully went into it until he started getting his own book. And 50 years later, the one thing I'll say is that of all the characters we've covered already, you could argue he's the most well-known, but when you're comparing him to Man-Thing and Howard the Duck, it's kind of a landslide.
Yeah. Well, question. When did he start getting his own book? He debuted in Spider-Man. How long was he hanging out with Spider-Man or being a villain in those books? I do remember a couple of those. Did he start getting his own origin story and whatnot?
So in his fourth or fifth appearance, they gave him his name, they revealed his name, and they talked about how his family was murdered in a mob hit. But that was in Marvel Preview, mm-hmm. which was, you know, black and white. It wasn't his own book. And it wasn't until, I want to say it was like the mid-80s, when he got his own book with Steve Grant was writing it. And that story also led into when I think it was Mike Barron who started writing The Punisher. So it wasn't until shortly before this movie went into development that The Punisher actually got his own book. But he's also been a character, much like a lot of Marvel quote-unquote heroes, his book got canceled a lot. Like, in the mid-90s, he had three runs going, and all of them were canceled. Now, let's also remember that one of the reasons why is because, for the longest of time, people didn't know what to do with The Punisher. And because of that, they basically threw shit at the wall. And this was a character who, I just picked a handful of notable Punisher storylines. I found one where he puts on blackface to infiltrate a mob ring. One where he's basically the Crow and gets resurrected as this vessel for various angels and demons to exact revenge as they saw fit. This is a character who met Archie in Riverdale. There was a crossover there because Archie witnessed a mob hit and the Punisher is hired to take him out.
Love those Archie crossovers.
For all the people who think the Punisher is this big badass who can, you know, do no wrong, he's got some crimes of his own he's got to answer for besides straight up murder.
Yeah. Wow.
And people wonder why comic books aren't taken seriously.
Dress in blackface. Jesus. Was that another 70s thing? Or was that 80s?
No, I want to say that was either the 80s or 90s.
Jesus.
But speaking of things that are kind of left forgotten, most people think that the Thomas Jane Punisher was the first live-action adaptation of this character. But we could go all the way back to 1989, the year superhero movies changed forever with the release of Tim Burton's Batman. And a lot of irony there based on some of the the context of this particular movie.
Well, yeah, that was the height. That was when people were really getting into comics. They had a real run back then. And I was very familiar with this particular movie in that I was playing Little League with a guy who is still one of my best friends to this day. And our very first night that we hung out together, and Adam is aware of this individual, we went to the video store and we rented this movie. So this has a little particular place in my heart in that it kind of brought me and him together, because we knew after that, it was like, okay, we're going to be friends forever, because all we did was sit and we laughed at this entire fucking movie. It's a pretty remarkable piece of cinema. It's pretty crazy, this thing we're about ready to discuss.
Well, one of the reasons why people forget this movie's existence is that it did not get a full theatrical run as initially intended, because we have to do some overview with where Marvel itself was at the time. This came out, and this movie's development happened right around the time that Marvel Comics was bought by New World Pictures, or / New World Entertainment, in 1980. It was like 86 or 87. And part of that was getting movies made of their heroes. And it's the funniest thing that, you know, New World Pictures was founded by Roger Corman, of all people, who is more well known for his Fantastic Four movie than The Punisher, but this is still kind of in a lot of ways, like a distant relative of that, because they have similar production histories, and neither of them got full-fledged releases as they were planned on. But Marvel was not in a good place around this time, as far as financially or with what movies they had. This is right after Howard the Duck, which, as we talked about earlier in the year, could have signaled the end of Marvel making movies, period.
Let's be honest, it should have signaled the end of Marvel making movies, period, and George Lucas for that matter. So Marvel, they sold their stock to New World and, what was it, Paramount too, or something, or was that later?
So not quite yet. Okay. So in 1989 is when Marvel was sold to McAndrews and Forbes, and you had the whole junk bonds situation. Okay. So right around the time this movie got released was when it changed hands, and they started selling off to any studio that wanted them, because they had to, because they were going to go bankrupt.
And this was also 2 years after Masters of the Universe, so this was Dolph Lundgren's follow-up to that. And my goodness, I know we're going to discuss Rocky next year, but Dolph Lundgren had a little bit of a run there, and then he kind of faltered, and this was kind of more proof that he cannot lead a movie.
Well, you're also forgetting in between was Red Scorpion.
Oh, that's right.
But Lundgren was not the original choice to play this character.
Oh my God, this is insane.
So the original choice was Christopher Lambert.
I'm sorry, I should do that again.
Now, anyone who knows Christopher Lambert, you immediately think of Highlander.
Yes.
Which you could argue is better than almost anything Dolph Lundgren has ever made. So at least they were looking at someone who, in an alternative multiverse type of world, I would have liked to have seen that, but he hurt his ankle and could not do the project. So
he did a Sean Young from Batman. He hurts himself and he can't go to the production.
Yeah, except I don't think he fell off a horse.
No, but still, it's like he had it and then it fucking slipped through his fingers. That's funny.
Although, unlike Sean Young, who probably cost herself millions of dollars,
yeah,
Christopher Lambert probably cost himself $20 in a Starbucks gift.
Didn't show up in a cat suit.
And speaking of hard to kill and characters who are above and characters who are above the law, Steven Seagal,
could you imagine, was
very interested in playing the Punisher.
Could you imagine? Oh,
get it. When you know Seagal from that time frame, like that tracks though. That does track. And if he got it, I could see the Punisher in comics being redone to follow Seagal's style. And that would be where we are today.
Well, yeah, I love Seagal films. I watch them every summer. He has a run of like 5 films that were theatrical that I go through every year. And his style was, I'm just going to stand here and let you come to me. So if you give him if you give him a set of guns and have him roam free, then yeah, that would be what he could do. So, yeah, I get it too, but at the same time, Seagal as a comic book character just makes me laugh my ass off because his fucking reputation wouldn't have allowed him, if this thing was successful, to go like two films. He would not have been able to do it because nobody wanted to work with him.
So let me make the proposal, and I was thinking in my head, who would I have cast as the Punisher to kind of draw butts in seats? Wouldn't you think Stallone would have been the obvious choice?
Well, yeah. Stallone and Schwarzenegger were the two people that you tried to get. And if you couldn't get them, you go for Dolph Lundgren. I can see Stallone doing this. Hell, didn't he kind of do this with Cobra?
Well, I mean, you're the disease, I'm the cure. That's basically the Punisher's modus operandi in a lot of runs. But
you're stepping on my notes for later on in this film.
You know, the Punisher is supposed to be this physically imposing guy where when you see him coming towards you and you're a criminal, you're just praying he kills you quickly. And that's kind of been, so let me put this out there. I think the Punisher has a fatal flaw as a character in almost every run. If you're trying to define him as a hero, every hero needs a tragic flaw. You know, Batman has his no kill rule that's gotten him into a lot of trouble. Spider-Man has the with great power comes great responsibility. The Punisher's tragic flaw is he's actually a villain. He has motives that you can have empathy for him based on where he's coming from, sort of like Magneto, where you understand his worldview, but he, like Billy Joel, goes to such an extreme. And that's why he works so well as a antagonist with characters like Daredevil and Spider-Man, where you can contrast him and the two of them with how they approach. Because Punisher also has a point with going after Daredevil, because Daredevil is a lawyer by trade, and when the system breaks down, Matt Murdock takes it into his own hands, and Frank Castle kind of sees him as, you know, a hypocrite. It's one of the great lines, "You're just one bad day away from being me."
Yeah, and one of the many flaws of this film is they give him a partner. Doesn't he, like, not have partners in the comics? Like, doesn't he kill his partners in
the comics? All right, so let's get into that. So the Punisher has always been a loner in almost every instance. You know, he's never been an Avenger. He's been involved with characters like teams like the Thunderbolts, or he'll work closely with like Nick Fury, but it's strictly a for the greater good or common goal. And it wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s where they brought in Microchip, who was kind of his Alfred. It's kind of his Alfred slash Q. Where he gives them all the tech and all the guns and stuff. But outside of that, he's never had, you know, he doesn't have a Robin. He doesn't have a true, like, confidant. Even characters like Daredevil, they'll team up to go after Kingpin or whatever, but they never really see eye to eye, not just because Daredevil is blind. So that's kind of why, and look, the Punisher, this movie, one last thing we should mention. So this movie was going to get a theatrical release in August of 89, which was a couple months after Tim Burton's Batman, put out trailers and everything. But New World, like a lot of Roger Corman productions, had financial difficulties. And because of that, it changed hands. And they basically said, we have no interest in putting this out in theaters. So they did it in select markets, Australia in particular, because this movie was predominantly shot there. And we'll talk about how you can tell. So that has that in common with Man-Thing. And it did make a decent chunk of money on home video.
Yeah, home video is where
The sucker on this podcast has mentioned, him and his friend watching it multiple times.
Yes. Yeah, home video is where it really found its footing. And I do remember theatrical trailers for this. I actually saw Hellraiser 2 in theaters. And there was a trailer for this before Hellraiser 2. So they did have intentions of releasing this in theaters.
Well, it's a lot like the year after with Albert Pune's Captain America. There were trailers, there were theatrical, you know, those poster cutout advertisements saying coming to theaters, and then it never, funny, Captain America never saw the light of day in his home country, and neither did the Punisher.
But I mean, even Spider-Man was going to have a movie same time. You know, they had posters and they had cast, and so fucking 90s Marvel. Thanks, Liefeld.
And there are now, there's a Blu-ray you can find, there is a DVD where there is an extended work print of this movie, and there is also a audio commentary done by the director, who we should also mention. This was James Cameron's editor. He did the first two Terminator films. He did True Lies. He did Last Boy Scout.
He worked with all of them. He worked with
RoboCop,
yeah,
Commando. Like, he's got a great track record of being an editor.
Yeah, I worked with Clive Barker, Michael Bay, Paul Verhoeven, Joel Schumacher, Rennie Harlan. He worked with all of them. I think he only has one other directing credit on his resume, but he's more of an editor. And I tell you, you can see the action roots here. You can definitely see where they would pluck this guy to take this on.
And the writer of this, Boz Gaiken, this was his first writing job, but he went on to, you know, he directed Remember the Titans, mm-hmm, and not much else of note. But yeah, but he's got a lot of writing credits.
Yeah, and another funny thing I noticed while watching this was it was given a once over by a gentleman by the name of Robert Mark Kamen, and if people don't know that name, they should be if they like the Karate Kid, because he's the guy who wrote all three of the original films, and he's also worked a lot with Luc Besson as well. So this guy has he has quite the track record when it comes to action, and I think we're going to talk about him again next week. So it's not like this production didn't have good resumes behind it. These aren't just two timers who are coming around and saying, let's just make this action film that we like based on this comic. There are people with action cred behind this production.
Well, speaking of credits, the movie opens with a stylized comic book-esque type of opening credits where it's a tracking shot going through the sewers, which, as we will find out, is where Frank Castle has made his residency. They're intercutting it with stills of illicit affairs. You know, they're showing mafia members, they're showing Yakuza, they're showing underground casinos, and it's also juxtaposed with a target going through all the different things. So, I mean, I'll give the movie this: for something that was made for not an exorbitant amount of money, I think these opening credits are more than serviceable.
I agree with that. I like the introduction to this character. Now, oh God, so these monologues that accompany this production weren't actually written by the writers. They were written by Dolph Lundgren himself. And if people know Dolph Lundgren's history, he is not a dumb guy, believe it or not. This is not just some lug who comes in off the streets. This is a guy who actually is like a chemical engineer. Like, he has a crazy...
He's got a master's degree.
Yeah, he's got a crazy master's degree in chemical engineering. And so it's not like he's stupid. And he took this script. He's like, I want to write these notes. I want to add these monologues. And, you know, I don't know the character, but it adds to the production. I'll say that. I kind of like him.
Yeah, I mean, they're fine. They get into it. It's for what the rest of this movie is, these should have been a whole lot worse.
So we then cut to a news feed where we're getting very brief. Now, much like Tim Burton's Batman, this is not an origin story. He's already established as the Punisher. In fact, they say he's been the Punisher for 5 years, and he's killed 125 people in that time frame. And the news reporter's talking about how there's a member of a crime family being released from prison who is connected to the murder of Frank Castle and his family. Now, this is comic accurate. But what is not, and this is a huge change that I have a big problem with, he's not a Marine, he's a cop.
Oh, so he's a Marine in the comics?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That is an important asset of the character. So there's a lot of things that I think, if you're going to do the Punisher quote-unquote right, much like Batman in my mind, there's certain key things you need to have. And I think him being a former soldier is very important, not just for his origin, but much like Batman, and Adam crucified Tim Burton for this, and I'm going to go after this movie pretty hard, and a certain other version that does this. I hate how the Punisher's origin is tied into a targeted attack on his family. As it was originally written, much like Batman, his family was killed because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They witnessed a mob hit gone wrong, and they were caught in the crossfire. And because of that, the Punisher, that's his origin, and he realizes, because they get off on through the justice system, that the system is broken and I got to clean it up. So making him not just a cop, but a direct target in an assassination, I think that is a huge betrayal of the character.
Yeah, where it really bugs me is the Punisher is, he can use any weapon. He can, as he goes through, he can pick up any weapon, he will use it, then drop it, and move himself on. That's his military, that's his special force. That's a part of how and why he can work the way he does. To just have him as a cop, and that, I don't mean that to be like just a cop, but it changes fundamentally why and how he can do the things he does, to the point that it's just not believable anymore. It's kind of crazy that way.
Not only that, but by making him a cop, he's not being distinctive from any other vigilante film you'd see in the 80s. You're just making him Cobra. You know, we've seen this type of movie a million times, and by the Punisher being a former soldier, that's how you make him stand out. And to Adam's point, that explains how he's such a masterful, not just marksman, but tactician. You know, he's Rambo in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, you guys just answered your own question. And look, as somebody who wasn't a fan of this comic, this would have kind of been my in. I don't have any problems with adapting a story the way you can, especially given the action genre at the time. Making him Rambo would have been something, you know, making him kind of like the ex-Marine, but I went with the fact that he was a cop. I didn't have any issues with this.
To be, it's, you brought it up already. This movie is Cobra. Like, 90% of this movie is Cobra, but it's also, it's every New York set vigilante cop movie that we have. You could put Charles Bronson in this role and this movie doesn't change very much. It is derivative from start to finish. There's just nothing on this that screams Punisher. It does scream 80s cop or 80s revenge vigilante.
Now, Adam, I mentioned when I first saw this, when did you first see this? Because I know I didn't watch this with you.
About 4 days ago.
Oh, that was your first time. Okay.
Look, it's I like Dolph Lundgren for a number of things, but I got a soft spot for I Come in Peace, oh, which God's I know, sake. Which
you me can't too. Even find. I'm
it.
With you.
I can't. You can't even find it anymore because for some reason, like 20 years ago, they renamed it to Dark Angel or something. I don't know. Maybe because the video game, but. This one, I don't care. I never cared. If it is a kid who loved to go to the R-rated section of the video store when I wasn't getting caught going through the swinging saloon doors, this was just, I don't care. So, yeah, it was only a few days ago.
Wow.
Now, let me also, I've made it clear, we've covered a lot of comic book movies. I am always fine with making changes as you see fit, as long as you get the essence of the character right. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is one of those instances where they're kind of, pardon the pun, they're missing the mark in a lot of ways. And part of that is because there is a lot of controversy among Punisher fans because never once in this movie do you see the skull on his chest.
That was a huge bit of contention. I do remember that. Yeah, people were not happy with that.
Now, it was not a licensing problem. It was not done. It was not hidden due to legalities. And to this day, if you listen to the commentary track, the director talks about how removing the logo, look, it would not have saved this movie, but it's again one of those things that's like having Superman without the S on his chest. That's a key part of the iconography. Or making a Captain America movie where he doesn't have a shield.
Yeah, but so, it's not an S though. It's just a skull. So I don't get the Superman comparison, but I can see how fans and people who love this character could get mad at that.
Funny that to me that is a logo that kind of stands out, and it's become so, I'll use it, been so corrupted in the last like 10 years that Marvel has now changed that logo twice in the last 5 years to try to distance itself and get copyright so they can start suing places for selling that logo in ways that it really should not be used, or at least should not be celebrated.
And I think that's a very key thing that modern Punisher writers have done very well, is there are a lot of people who have taken that logo upon themselves, whether it's select vigilante groups or, you know, police subsections. Not a hint
of fucking irony.
Yep. But there is a comic where, I can't remember who wrote it, and this is a great contrast with this movie. The Punisher does not like cops.
No.
Because he says, if you guys did your job, you wouldn't need me. And there's a run where there's a bunch of, like, cops who are dirty and they kill criminals without getting them to the justice system. And they sort of fanboy out over running into the Punisher. And they like try to take selfies with them. And Punisher openly says, if you want a role model, go look for Captain America. Like, the fact that you idolize me is a huge problem. So I do appreciate that the character, they've recognized the inherent problem with associating yourself with him or idolizing him. And it kind of makes this movie all the funnier in hindsight, because this is a character who's historically hates cops, but they made him a cop in this.
That is but ironic.
We cut to outside the courthouse where the Father Fettuccini or whatever his name is, because this movie is, we got, I'll give the movie this, it's very theatrical and comic book-ish with the stereotypical crime families between not just the Italians, because there's another part of the world that gets stereotyped in a big way.
Yeah, but you got them all covered here. You got like the Godfather mixed in with with straight up Arnold action films. It's funny. It's just
now,
funny.
Now, I do consider this faithful, though, because the Punisher has always worked best when he's going against the mob. Because I've never liked when they have the Punisher going up against, like, superpowered beings, because it's such a stark contrast. I like him staying in his own bubble. In the Marvel universe, he can do the things that other heroes just can't do, and him going after the mob, I think, works well for him. Now, the surprising thing is, you would think that Kingpin would have been like, they would have used like an actual villain from the comics, because around this time, much like the Punisher himself, Kingpin started out as a Spider-Man villain. And while he's been very involved in that character, he's become much more associated with Daredevil and the Punisher than he has been with Spider-Man.
Yeah, I was aware of that, because, again, I was a Spider-Man reader, so I was aware that Kingpin did originate in Spider-Man, and yeah, he did move on to Punisher and Daredevil later on.
Now, I think part of that is because Trial of the Incredible Hulk had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
You had Wilson Fisk in that movie. They don't call him Kingpin, and we'll talk about that. But the mobster is basically cutting a, you know, they got Mean Gene Okerlund interviewing him, and he's saying, if the Punisher ever... This is a wrestling promo where he's basically like, if the Punisher ever comes up within 1,000 yards of me, he'll find out what the word punished really means. Let me tell you something else, brother. He gets in his Benz and he drives away, and you see standing in the distance this leather clad. I mean, this the Punisher wears so much leather in this movie that he might as well be in a Prince music video.
Well, the aesthetic, I think you got it right, man. This is professional wrestling, and professional wrestling was huge at this time. So I can see why they would go for that aesthetic.
So the Mafia Don goes back to his house, and he's saying, break open the champagne, we're going to celebrate, but first go check the rooms. We have not yet seen the Punisher's face, but he enters the upstairs, and much like Rambo, we're seeing him take out these guys in... between throwing knives, he hangs a guy and then drops him. So for a movie based on the Punisher, they're not shying. Like, this is not a bloodless movie, which I appreciate. Like, it doesn't go as far as you think it would, given it's the 80s, but it's certainly more brutal than you would certainly in compared to like Tim Burton's Batman.
For something where, regardless of its release, they know they're making a movie that came from comic books, making anything R-rated is really risky. So the fact that this gets pushed as well as it goes is a testament to at least being able to get away with that.
So he kills the Mafia Don. And one thing about the Punisher in this movie, to equate to professional wrestling, he knows how to make an entrance. And he also knows how to make an exit, because we get his calling card in this movie. While he doesn't wear the skull on his chest, he embroids all the ends of his knives with skulls, so at least they kind of kept it in. You see him sort of in the way that people would see Batman as a glimpse, like you don't get a clear shot of him. And then he blows the mansion to smithereens.
Yeah.
Nice explosion.
Yeah, there are some good explosions here. Again, you have an action director with action cred here. So, yeah. Well, as far as the aesthetics go, I have no complaints with this film. There are times when the film is grainy and it doesn't have the best photography in the world. But as far as aesthetics go, I think if you're going to make a Punisher movie, this is the aesthetic you go for.
I do have a big problem with also, this front part, though, and it's going to continue throughout, and it gets more glaring as this film goes. I am very, very aware when I am watching not Dolph Lundgren as the Punisher in this film. For reading that, oh, he did 90% of his stunts, it's him most of the time, bullshit. He has got such an imposing figure. I mean, Dolph Lundgren's a mass of a man. And when they're hiding behind his stunt double in that, I am keenly aware that I'm not watching Dolph Lundgren.
It kind of reminds me of when Michael Keaton's not in the suit for Batman.
Yeah, it moves.
It's kind of clear as day, but... I do like that the Punisher, he's been active for 5 years. They give you flashes of the car bombing that killed his family. What I don't like are these, and Garrett mentioned it, these monologues where, because it's a comic book movie, they're trying to give him like those narration boxes that you would find. But not only is the writing really bad, we're talking about like basically yelling at God, and I don't know why he's bare ass.
So I'm watching this, right? I'm watching this in my living room. My wife walks in and goes, oh, you're watching Hellraiser. He's sitting there drenched in sweat, you know, like that scene that we get with, and it's funny because Uncle Frank, where he's got the puzzle box.
Yeah.
But these monologues, yeah. It's funny that whoever wrote this apparently read some of the Daredevil run, because Frank Castle in this, the way he's talking to God and all that, and his tortured soul, is exactly what we get from Matt Murdock in those books. Well, and somebody conflated the two.
Well, Lundgren wrote them himself. These are all Lundgren penned monologues. And let's talk about Lundgren. A, what's up with the fake beard?
Holy he's gotta get hell.
You couldn't grow a fucking beard. And I have a lot of positive things to say about Lundgren as far as how smart of a guy he is, but for his acting, Stallone was right. You do not give this guy lines to read. The way he delivers lines, the way he's mumble mouth, and we're going to talk about Louis Gossett later on, and he can't interplay with him that well. He has never been a good actor. He doesn't really have an accent presence that you can root for. He really stonewalls this fucking production, and it stops it from being an enjoyable action fare, and makes it into something that I just was not into. You know, you might as well have put Christopher Lambert here or any one of these guys from the early 90s into this production, because nothing about this guy makes me like him.
He's got roles that are great for him. Like, look, Masters of the Universe, I think he's absolutely perfect as Prince Adam in that film.
Oh,
like,
stop.
I think he's cast. No, he's exactly what that movie needs. Well, other than Gwildor. Frank Langella, thank you. But as an actor, the dude just doesn't cut it. You know, I mean, he's not a thespian. I do think he's an amazing presence. I do think it's stunning that he did not make a Predator film in the 80s and 90s, because holy hell, how do you not make that work? But Jesus, this is not his role. And that beard, it's almost like his face is the skull, because that beard is painted on in such a, I'm like, wait, did I? And I got to pause it and look, and I'm like, that is just makeup. Holy hell, that's not even beard black. It's just fucking makeup.
Yeah, dude, you hit it for me. We just discussed Predator. Put this guy in that fucking costume, you know, after Kevin Peter Hall passes away. He'd be perfect for that, but don't give him lines like this, and don't put him in front of a camera and expect him to endear yourself to your audience.
So, as far as Lundgren nowadays, I think he's gotten better. Like, he's one of the only things I like in The Expendables. And I like him in Aquaman for what he does. And he gets a decent amount of dialogue in both of those. But I think this was just, he wasn't capable of taking on this type of role, because the Punisher has to internalize a lot as a character. You know, it's a lot of, in a lot of ways, self-loathing. And, you know, just this, he fights this endless war, much like Batman. And I just don't think Lundgren is capable of competently portraying that. And to the point of the fake beard, it's not like the Punisher has always been drawn with 5 o'clock shadow or looking like how Ray Stevenson will look 20 years after this. So I don't understand why they felt the need to do that. I mean, the black hair dye is already bad enough. It looks like that spray on hair that you would see in those QVC commercials where you spray, it's like a can of paint and it looks like actual hair. It's that bad.
Yeah. I mean, look, I have no doubt that Dolph Lundgren, even to this day, could kick my ass. But at the same time, you're not selling the fact that you have dark hair, sir. This is just a terrible dye job all around.
We cut to the remnants of the bombing, where we're introduced to Detective... God, I'm going to butcher this last name. I'm just going to call him Detective Jake. Played by Louis Gossett Jr., second time he has appeared after Jaws 3.
How have we discussed this guy twice in a couple months? I have no idea. I love seeing him here, although in the beginning, he's pretty dialed down. He is not the over-exaggerated Calvin Bouchard in the beginning. Now, he does have a moment in this that to this day makes me laugh my ass off every time I see it. But mostly, he's kind of dialed down during this film.
Yeah, interesting get. I had no idea that he was in this movie, and I'm glad, because I think throughout this movie, not only is he an officer, but he's a gentleman.
Oh my God. Jesus Christ. He's so proud of it, too.
You have no idea?
I'm not even going to dignify that with a response. But as we come to find out, he's Frank's former partner. You know, this is basically if Riggs went insane after his wife died and just stopped being a cop, and, you know, Murtaugh had to chase him down. You know, that's funny. Like, Mel Gibson would have been a great Punisher.
I can see that.
Not just because he's wearing Mad Max's outfit through most of this movie.
Oh my God, he is.
But Jake is convinced that Frank and the Punisher are one and the same, even though he's been declared dead. We're also introduced to who will become his current partner. And I feel like this female character was only written into this movie and this turned out to not be true, so she could fight the head of the Yakuza later on, because you can't have a man the size of Dolph Lundgren fighting a woman. Mm-hmm. Although this movie says, oh yeah, watch this.
Yeah, this, you know, I made a different comparison, Matt. I found this to be kind of a follow-up to RoboCop. I think they're playing off that.
Oh yeah, she's Nancy Allen.
Yeah, she's playing off Nancy Allen. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but Nancy Allen acts circles around this chick. This chick is awful.
Oh yeah, I miss Nancy Allen.
Yeah, exactly. She's got the same haircut. But she is death when she's on screen.
And if you believe the reports, Nicole Kidman was going to play this part.
Yeah, I saw that. Adam would have been in love.
Would have seen it.
But he tells her, you know, show up to my office tomorrow to get started. And then we cut to, I mean, look, 10 minutes in, this movie is introducing a lot of characters.
Yes.
Which I do, I will sort of compliment in that this does feel... This feels very comic bookish, the way they like do all these different cuts and you're meeting new characters, not a whole lot of exposition. They get it out of the way with Frank's origin and like a newsreel, which I think is actually an inventive way to do it. But we're introduced to Franco, who is the head of this mob family in New York, played by Jerome Crabb, who had just played a Bond villain
in
The Living Daylights.
Yeah.
And he's not as over the top as I thought he would be. But I kind of feel like he's sort of a weak link. Like, I don't feel like he's playing it up enough.
A weak link with a movie with Dolph Lundgren? You're saying this is the weak link? This guy is much better than Lundgren in this movie. I could have seen him being the Punisher. This guy has kind of an action credit. He's done some credits. You know, he'd been around at this time. Definitely a face that you recognize when you see him. I don't have a problem with his presence in this. I just have a problem with the way he's written.
Yeah, he's fine. The issue thing, well, for me, it's just we get redundancies throughout the villains in this. So I'm just, whatever. He's okay. If you're going to have, he's no Kingpin.
Yeah. And he's also the way that there's something that happens in that drives the third act of this movie where I'm like, the Punisher would never do this.
Fucking thank you.
Not to play that card, but I'll reveal it when we get to it. And we're also introduced to his son, Tommy, which I didn't realize this movie was going to have, you know, this like X-Men 2 where we're going to save the kids.
Well, this was kind of my in as a teenager, you know. You put kids in these movies to appeal to people like me when we rented this when we were 12 years old.
Yeah, but this is a hard R. That's kind of a weird...
That's true. But you're still trying to appeal to teenage boys, the same teenage boys that went and saw Batman, the PG-13 Batman. So I see why you do this, but I don't know if it has any place in this movie. I get the impulse to do this.
So he tells his confidant that they got a plan to work, unite the families, and you do that through smuggling drugs, because the one crime that everyone can agree to is smuggling drugs and making money off it, so they're going to meet at the docks later. Mm-hmm. And then the movie cuts to, I don't even know, all right, so you see this drunken bum walk into a bar, and he gets thrown out, and I'm sitting there going, okay, he's got an accent, you know, he's clearly Australian. He gets thrown out of the bar, and then you see a bottle of scotch on a little like Tonka truck that's being remote controlled by the Punisher, and we find out that this bum has been working with Frank as his like informant.
Yeah, and this is when
only in the 80s.
Yeah, this is when we can tell also that we're not in America anymore.
Oh God, no! Now worth noting that is Miranda Otto's father.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
And he tells, you know, tells Frank that they're meeting at the docks. They also do this weird thing where he talks in rhyme like he's the Mad Hatter. Like, I don't know. Like, I know Micro wasn't around yet, and they're like, okay, we have to come up with some kind of way that the Punisher can get information. But then why did you have to contrive him not talking to his partner for 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was your end. That's your end. That's how you explain that.
Exactly.
We then cut to the docks where the drug deal turns out to have gone wrong because they're ambushed by a bunch of people in swimsuits and, you know, dive suits is a better example. But you're seeing the Punisher in action. You know, he's taking people out. He's got a crossbow and he shoots a guy, so he sticks to the truck. People are getting stabbed by shurikens. So right away, I'm like, okay, so clearly they're going to fight the Yakuza. That's kind of a giveaway. And you think the Punisher gets shot and thrown into the lake, or thrown into the water, and he's going to be, you know, washed up on the beach somewhere. For what it is, this is a decent action sequence. Like, we're 20 minutes in, and I'm like, okay, I'm not giving this movie a pass. But for the resources they had, this is about what I would have expected.
Oh, yeah. You're diving into the late 80s action realm. So this is exactly what I would expect. I don't really have any issues with the action scenes in this. The only real issue I have is that there comes a point when there's too many bullets. And Punisher shoots way too many fucking bullets in this movie. But other than that, I really have no issues with the action here.
Well, he's got the infinite ammo cheat on throughout this entire movie because there is a scene where he blows way too much ammunition for a guy who's supposed to be working with limited resources.
Oh, my favorite scene of the movie.
Because they never answer, okay, where is he getting all of his firearms from? Mm-hmm. And more importantly, how has he not run into the Ninja Turtles?
Thank you. Like, this, I figure that's why the kids are here.
Yeah, this reminds me so much of, like, not just the photography and the sewer layout. It looks like the 1990 Ninja Turtles, not just because they're fighting Asians. But they cut to the next day where we're seeing the remnants of the hit gone wrong with Jake and his new partner, and he sees the calling card of the Punisher's knife. We then cut to Frank literally cutting himself with a knife to get the bullet out, because much like Ivan Drago, apparently the Punisher just cannot feel pain.
I wonder what his punching power is.
And that's another problem I have with the Punisher, where they've kind of made him, yes, he can push himself to limits based on his background, but it gets to like almost a Wolverine level of, okay, does this guy have a healing factor we don't know about?
Yeah, because also a big issue that I have with this movie is at one point they say, you want to wear your bulletproof vest? He goes, no, I don't go with bulletproof vest. Like, really, dude? Like, isn't his whole calling card in the comic being in Kevlar the entire series? Why would he turn down having fucking a bulletproof vest? That's the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
No, because at least that you could have, that's where the skull is. So if you wanted to appease the fans, you save it for the third act.
But he doesn't wear one at all.
No, I know, but I'm saying like that would have been the impetus. If he's not going to wear it for the start of the movie, mm-hmm. he puts it on for that.
Yeah. Of course they don't, because they make it a freaking plot point in that ridiculous thing.
And then cut to the meeting of the mob, which looks like this is basically, in a lot of ways, it mirrors Tim Burton's Batman in a lot of ways. Where this is, because Lady Tanaka basically comes in like the Joker and just takes over.
Yeah, I can see that.
And she says, you know, I'm taking over your enterprise, 75-25. It's not a negotiation, it's a demand. Because we already have the Italian mafia, and now we got full-blown Yakuza, which are... Is this a prequel to Showdown in Little Tokyo?
We're also starring Dolph Lundgren.
That's why I made that joke.
Good one. Here's the thing about this subplot. We were scared to death of the Japanese around this time. They were taking over our cars. They were taking over our TVs. And Adam, you could vouch for this, right? This is something that was real around this time. So I get why you go for the fear behind this. And I also get why... I'm also going to pay this movie another compliment. You don't see women in these roles around this time. So they plug this girl into this huge role of villainous in this. I actually give this movie some credit for this. I kind of liked it.
I like her. I think she's cool. I think she's a better villain than not Danny Houston that we get playing the Italian mob boss. But yeah, at this point, it was kind of a, ooh, Yakuza, Yakuza, Yakuza. Like, it was just the cool thing because you were bringing something different to, you know, these street vigilante movies around this time. But I like this group more than I do the mob group, but it is superfluous in what we have.
Adam, you agree with me, right? I mean, this was a real thing that our country was scared to death of this actually happening to us.
Oh, yeah, it was just another part of the sell xenophobia to get votes type of thing. But yeah, we absolutely were, mm-hmm. because it was a change in how certain things were being done. Oh, yeah.
We then cut to Jake and his partner going through the map where he has marked every place that the Punisher has attacked. And she comes up with the bright idea. Have you ever looked beneath the streets?
Because it's got sewer system like Gotham City does.
Yeah, this sewer system runs infinitely around this city.
Like, it makes you wonder why there aren't giant alligators. These caverns are big enough to drive a fucking motorcycle through. So in order to dissuade the mob from doing any type of backing out, we then see a brief little montage of random kids who we find out are the kids of the mobsters getting abducted, one of which the maid gets like shot, the nanny gets shot, you see the panda bear fall, and the kids just get kidnapped. I'm like, wow, we just entered a different movie.
Yes.
This is like this scene. Holy hell.
What in 180? Yeah. Oh,
kids playing, and then you just, the blood splatter and everything mm-hmm. else. But this cracks me up because the amount of kids that are just like, hey, our fathers are rich gangsters.
not mine. But like all these kids know, they're just like, oh, fuck.
So they all get kidnapped and they're all being held in this the same skyrise building that the Yakuza have their headquarters in, right down to a freaking dojo in the middle of.
Yes.
Their office space. Like, I love how they're every stereotypical thing we could think of, we are just cramming into this movie.
Uh-huh. Which,
you know, in a certain place, I like how theatrical and over the top a lot of this is. And I think it works, though, to a certain degree, because I like doing this in a world where the Punisher is very, you know, he's the thing that keeps everything grounded. The problem is Lundgren is just not capable of pulling that off.
Exactly.
You know, and all the kids are like, oh, we're going to be sold into white slavery. I love how the kid tries to, you know, smack the chair over the Yakuza, but it's not very effective, and they just carry him away.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of cliched things, we get an underground illegal casino where you see this tracking shot. They're doing the Goodfellas tracking shot before Goodfellas came out.
Yes.
So you're seeing a blonde woman. I'm thinking, is this Jake's partner, like, wearing a wig? And she's infiltrating this. But no, this is Tanaka's daughter, who is straight out of a James Bond film because she's got killer earrings.
Yes, she does.
Which I do appreciate, because I'm like, how has Bond never thought of that? So the scene... You know, we talked about this came out around Tim Burton's Batman. He literally breaks through a fucking skylight like Michael Keaton's Batman does in 89.
And I can't just believe.
Blows through five clips of ammunition.
This was in all the trailers for this, or maybe all two of the trailers that they did for this. I remember this scene very well because of that. And my favorite scene of the movie. I could watch slot machines getting blown up all goddamn day. 2 points higher just for this fucking scene alone.
See, and I'm crying because I would love a couple of these slot machines in my garage or game room.
You are like, more than welcome to come, sir, and take these.
But I could not believe the temerity of having him drop through the skylight like this. Oh, shit.
I get coincidence is a funny thing, but that's a very, very specific coincidence to have alongside Batman.
Well, you mentioned it was in August of 89, and Batman would come out in June of 89. So I don't know if a 2 months' time is enough time in 1989 to insert this. I think it is just coincidence, but it is an awful interesting coincidence.
So after Punisher has, at least we're seeing him just give no fucks about collateral damage. It's like, if you were in his way, he will literally just use you as a meat shield if he has to.
Yeah, and going back to 89 Batman 2, Matt, real quick. In a couple weeks' time, we'll be talking about a completely derivative 1989 callback. So this is nothing compared to that.
And in a lot of ways, we'll talk about these Punisher movies, they borrow a lot from each other, but they're all three very different movies.
Oh, yeah.
Which I find very fascinating. And speaking of Batman, the Punisher goes to a rundown carnival that looks like the Joker's hideout from The Killing Joke.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of that. I remember a Dirty Harry movie doing this too around this time. Yeah, this was
Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was a go-to around that time.
So speaking of go-tos, he goes inside the roller rink. This is where I think they go too far with the absurdity, where the Yakuza are literally sliding down the metal slides. It looks overly choreographed, like they prepared this shit. And I appreciate him just hucking grenades and them, you know, having the stunt doubles flip around. But sometimes I feel like this movie is going too far, and then in other places it's not going far enough. Like, I appreciate the heightened aspects, but Lundgren is playing this so like deadpan that he's not even giving a performance, and it contrasts even worse when they start giving him one-liners in a little bit because he can't deliver them.
Yeah, this was the era of Arnold one-liners, and the problem is you don't give these one-liners to Dolph.
Now, I do appreciate, like, this movie at least recognizes the Punisher is not invulnerable because he gets captured, and we get, you know, a torture sequence where they put him on the rack. He won't give up that he's working alone, but they have his confidant. And so this is where we get a really weird editing glitch from a movie that was directed by an editor. So they get the doctor on the rack, but he's wearing heels for some reason.
That was so bizarre. I had to rewind it. I'm like, is he wearing? Yes, he is. He's wearing heels. What's up?
I'm like,
that?
So did they put those on him as a joke, like to fuck with him, or was nobody just not paying attention? It's so jarring.
It is. It's very jarring. Yeah, it doesn't even come off as a character trait. I think you're right. I think they did it for height reasons or whatever, but it doesn't make any sense within the context of what they show.
I honestly think it was to get him in frame with Dolph, and yeah. They forgot that they were on.
I love New World so much.
So we then cut to Jake and his partner in the sewers, and speaking of Ninja Turtles, they're wearing April O'Neil's yellow jacket.
Oh, yeah.
So this one, we find out that, you know, he was Frank's partner and he had a drinking problem. So working with Frank kind of kept him steady. And then we cut to, all right, this is my favorite scene in the movie. So they pull a Sopranos where they go into a restaurant and all the extras are plants by the Yakuza. And they just fucking shoot everybody. Yes. I laughed so hard at this.
I love it. Love it.
Like, this is a Naked Gun gag. And of course, they poison the glasses. Like, this movie is a great... If you're a struggling alcoholic, this movie will never make you want to drink it. Anytime someone opens champagne, they die horribly.
An anti-alcohol message. Nice, Matt.
Yeah. Well, it's like Jason with abstinence. If you drink, the Punisher will get you. And the Punisher not only has no qualms about murder, he has no qualms about carjacking, because we see him take a bus.
Yes. Oh, yes. The bus.
Now, I do love where he's like, hey, you missed my stop, and the Punisher gives him his money back. But he goes to rescue the kids. We're going full Temple of Doom here, boys.
Oh, yeah. But is this a Punisher instinct, though? Is this an impulse that he would have? You guys are saying that he doesn't.
Well, he protects the innocent, but this is also a character who has... there is a comic where he shoots a kid for being involved in a drug deal.
Oh, my goodness.
And he feels no remorse about it. So, you know, the Punisher's morality has always been very... questionable to be nice.
He shoots a kid,
you know. And I'm not saying they make him too heroic here, but he is very much going out of his way to go save these kids.
Mm-hmm.
I think if Frank was watching the news and saw that there was a bunch of kids that got kidnapped, I don't see him as the one that's gonna go and be like, all right, here's my plan for today.
Daredevil did this with
and this movie thinks he's Daredevil with a gun.
That's very true too. Like, and honestly, this story, it is very Daredevil-ish in a lot of ways. And the Punisher is also a hardcore atheist. Like, he openly does not believe in God.
Yeah.
So giving him all these monologues where he's yelling at God makes no sense. But the Punisher nevertheless saves all the kids. They get on the bus. And I also love in movies, I love watching dummies get run over, because they cut to a guy falling out of the car. He gets run over. There's a wide shot where I half expected his head to explode like a bomb with toothpaste.
Like a watermelon.
Like, I half expected it to be like that scene in Maximum Overdrive.
Oh, yeah.
But while he does save the kids, we get some explosions here. So, you know, this is not one of those movies where you're wondering, where did the money go? They're at least using what the budget allocated for.
Definitely. Yeah, the action here is very competent, and it is all on screen. You're absolutely right.
Except I am so aware that unless his face is in frame and focused, that it's not Dolph Lundgren.
Wow,
it's
are really on that.
I can't not see that it's not him. Even in some of the big action scenes, like the casino and that, I'm like, great, I know when they're beating him up and they close up on his face, it's him. Other than that, I know it's not. And it pisses me off.
Well, given what the next scene is, I could have done without seeing Dolph Lundgren whatsoever, because this scene with him and Louis Gossett Jr. yelling at each other, I've seen soap operas with better delivery than what Dolph Lundgren's doing here.
Yeah, he is not a thespian.
And he's, you know, this is the conversation where he's like, you know, and this is where the movie doesn't understand the Punisher, where he's like, you know, you're a cop, you're supposed to uphold the law. He might as well say, I am the law. Like, he might as well be Judge Dredd.
How can you not think that during this?
You got to admit, though, Lou Gossett Jr. had an easier time acting next to a shark than he did Dolph Lundgren.
And we also get like a nightmare sequence where he's having PTSD. They use the same goddamn B-roll footage of him driving through the sewers.
Uh-huh.
Now the other change is in the comics, he has a son and a daughter, and this, it's two daughters. I mean, that's kind of a minuscule change, whatever. So the Punisher is going to be taken to court immediately to face murder charges of 125, but Franco breaks him out of jail and says, help me rescue my son. To which the real Punisher would just shoot him and be done with it. He would never work with a mobster, much less the mobster that inadvertently killed his family.
This was such a like, I, God knows I did not want to stop, rewind, or pause this movie, but I'm like, wait, is that, did they just have Frank? This is like Joker killing freaking Martha. Like, this just, Frank would never, at, like, no matter what, he would not do this. He would die first. And not to mention,
he'd put a bullet in his head and then go rescue his kid.
Yeah, and if it came down to it, he would take Garrett's stance on it. Fuck those kids.
Wait a second. Okay.
And he even says, like, hey, I'm sorry that bomb was meant for you. It was not meant for your family. I'm like, that's the last thing you should say to this guy. And he tells him, like, you know, I'll help you, but I'm still going to kill you. And then we cut to a scene right out of Lethal Weapon where Jake gets himself out of handcuffs by pretending to take a piss, and he just grabs a piece of pizza as he walks off screen.
Oh my fucking God. My favorite scene that we have covered in a long time. I had to pause the movie, boys. I was laughing my ass off at this. Loved it. We have seen a dialed down Lou Gossett Jr. the majority of this movie, but this made me fucking die. I was laughing so hard at this. Loved it. I wanted more of this Lou Gossett Jr. in this movie, honestly.
It's funny, but the movie has also been very, I mean, Dower's being kind, that this scene is clearly improvised.
Improvised, out of place, everything you can mention. But I love the fact that they left it in.
And then the movie becomes Assault on Precinct 13, where you have a cop and a criminal teaming up, and it becomes a siege movie. It's like The Raid, where they have to work their way up the tower to the final boss.
Yeah, and I like the aesthetics here. I like the red. They go in this red room just filled with red light, and this was cool for me. I see that they're going into hell. Guys, I gotta admit, man, I was dreading coming into this. I was really, like, not wanting to put up with Dolph for an hour and a half, and looking forward to the fact that I was gonna have Lou Gossett Jr. again. But that was the only light I saw at the end of this fucking long-ass fucking sewer tunnel. But I'm having much more fun with this than I was expecting.
For you. I'm not. Some of this looks good. I will absolutely give it that. I can't help but roll my eyes, though, when they walk into this room with the training Yakuza and they stand there like the Sylvester Stallone freaking shot and just empty clips. Yes. For what feels like an hour but is only like 90 seconds. And they kill everybody and not a single round goes through the paper walls of that dojo.
Yes,
that's what I'm thinking of, is how did not a single round get through.
Well, it's also great they got the one last guy who still thinks he can finish the job. Yes. that just comes out of nowhere and he gets stabbed with the katana. So Frank has to fight Tanaka's daughter. I like the lights get cut to red, and I'm kind of shocked that the movie lets them go as far as he just breaks her neck.
Yeah,
I thought this was great. You don't see this today, more or less in the 80s. I was really glad that
James Bond never did this.
Mm-hmm. No, he just schmacked her around a bit.
Yeah, well, Bond had to contrive, like, hooking Famke Janssen to a helicopter to kill her.
Yeah.
Squeeze.
Yeah, if you're going to distinguish this character, you guys are saying that he has no morals when it comes to killing. This is how you do it. I like this.
So like this, she puts up a fight.
Yeah, for
you
sure.
You know, she, you know, they goes a bit. Like, this was best fight of the film, and it's not even close.
And it's not bad enough. They've borrowed a lot from Batman 1899. Tanaka is literally wearing geisha makeup that makes her look like the Joker.
Oh, yeah.
And she makes Franco put the gun in his mouth and pull the trigger. But before he can do it, Frank comes out of nowhere, throws a knife into her head, and you think the movie's over, but nope. Now, this ending was reshot, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell because they had to reconstruct this set, and it's painfully obvious because it just looks like they put up a couple sheets of drywall.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that, but I'm literally watching it going, what just happened? Hang on, did somebody change clothes? I knew something was off, and I rewound it like 10 seconds, 30 seconds. And okay, I'm glad you said that because I couldn't put together what it was, but I knew something was off.
No, this was reshot, and he says, see you in Hell Castle, but they have as good of fisticuffs as you can have for someone fighting Dolph Lundgren. It's somewhat believable.
You know what, though? They put the guns down and they fight. I was becoming numb to all the bullets going off here. You know, I'm all for all the action. Go back to Lethal Weapon. I like a good action scene. I like a good shoot 'em up. But there was just way too much shoot, not enough fight. And now we're getting more fighting. And you know what? Dolph Lundgren is a trained martial artist. He is a champion martial artist. So let him thrive.
So he winds up killing Franco, and Tommy holds him at gunpoint, and Frank tells him to do it. And he doesn't, and he says, all right, He basically threatens him. He says, "You better grow up to be a good person, or I'm going to come back and kill you when you're older."
This like, was this is weird. Freaking
Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah, this was weird. You would not see this in films back in the 80s. Most of the time that they'd send the kid off saying, "I'll be here whenever you need," or whatever. Like, they would say something that would encourage him. But no, he's just like, "You come back, I'll kill you." Pretty insane way to leave this.
Well, the movie's not over yet, because the Punisher, much like Batman, has to get away. And they smash cut to Jake yelling, "Frank," on the roof. And you think the movie's over. I'm like, okay, 85 minutes. But no, we got one last monologue from Lundgren where he's talking about, "I'm still waiting for an answer. And until I get one, I'm going to be out there watching. And I'm going to punish the guilty." And boy, this movie felt like punishment in a lot of ways. But it's only 85 minutes. Like, this is not a, it's not a long movie by any means.
Nope.
But we went longer talking about it.
Damn it.
Before the edit.
So, speaking of punishing, is this movie guilty? Time to deliver our verdicts. So, Garrett, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give The Punisher 1989?
God damn it. I fucking hate when you go to me first. You know what? I've kind of already given my summarization in that coming in, I was not looking forward to watching this. I do have this in my collection because when we were planning on doing Marvel way back when, I bought a whole bunch of things Marvel, and this was one of the things I got, and I was dreading putting this in for this review. Given that I had, I don't want to say fond memories of it, but I had memories of it from way back when I was a teenager, and I wasn't sure whether those would live up to expectations. And guess what? It does. This is nothing more than a late 80s, late 70s combination of junk. But you know what? Sometimes you just want a hamburger. You don't want a steak meal. And I'll take this hamburger. Now, the big issues, Lundgren, a big bit of miscasting. I do not like him in this lead. I don't like what they do with him. I don't like the distracting fucking dye job and beard that we talked about earlier. I don't like his line deliveries. However, I love Lou Gossett Jr. in this. It is directed by a very competent action editor. And I like the fact that he got his opportunity. He took advantage of it. There's going to be no depth here. You're not going to get any sort of rigs. I'm about ready to commit suicide. Now I find the light of life. No, you're not going to get any of that here. You're just going to get a slam bang late 80s action film, and that's what I came here for. So I'm going to go 6.5. Yes, I'm going to go 0.5 on this. It's nothing great. It's not even that good. However, I could sit and watch this, and I have a feeling this will be the highest score I will give in this retrospective. We'll get to the movies when we get to them. But yeah, 6.5 for 1989 Punisher.
I don't even know what to say. Adam, go ahead.
Now you know how I felt when Adam gave us Jaws 3 a 6.
Well, this is one that I had never seen before, but I was kind of ready for it. I thought what I was going to get from a late 80s Marvel Knights era of comic movie adaptation that was going to be just schlock, Black Rain type of movie. I'm not. Whatever I thought I was in for, it's worse. It's so much worse. Look, I like Dolph Lundgren in the movies that he's right for. He's not right for this one. Nobody is. There is nobody who's right for this film because it's not written well. It's shot in focus 90% of the time. That's about as good as I'm going to say. I'm not even going to say it's shot well because it's shot like so much Cinemax quality films. And that's what this is. It's not a Punisher film. It's a vengeance movie, but Frank Castle is not who this guy is. The kid aspect of it. Okay, great. I hope this mobster son, unless he grows up to be Kevin McAllister, I don't care who he is later on in life. Lou Gossett Jr., it's not the worst thing we've seen. I mean, this is the worst thing we've seen him in this year. And we reviewed Jaws the Revenge. Jaws 3. Man, I can't believe how unfulfilling this was. There's a reason the Punisher can't keep a series for a long time, and you know, I got one version of Frank Castle that I like to read in comic books, and that's Cosmic Ghost Rider, where Frank Castle becomes the Herald of Galactus and Ghost Rider all in one. It's a character that I don't give a shit about because I don't think it's a hero in any aspect. I think this is a piss poor movie. I don't know if it's going to get any better, but from what I understand, maybe it does. But I couldn't even find my freaking Oakley Video Friday night rental fun. I'm glad for those that can, but it's not for me. I was going to give this a 4, but I'm even angrier when I remember how this thing ended. So I'm giving it a 3/10. There's no reason to watch this.
Well, there is a reason to watch this if you're a completionist and you want to see the full pantheon of Marvel productions. And I'm sort of stuck between both of you. I don't feel as angry about this as Adam does, but I also cannot give it an outright endorsement like Garrett did for two reasons. One, even as someone who's not the biggest Punisher fan, but there are runs I really like, I don't think this is a good representation of the character. He feels just like every generic post-Paul Kersey type of vigilante, and that removes a lot of the uniqueness from his characterization. But at the same time, coming off of Howard the Duck, Man-Thing, and Dr. Mordred, I do think this is kind of a step in the right direction, but that's because I'm stepping from a pile of shit into broken glass. I don't enjoy either experience, but one is at least more forgiving than the others. And it's also only 85 minutes. This was not a 2-hour slog. This was not something where I felt like my time was wasted, but I also view comic book movies on a scale of, if you make changes, are you still a good representation of the material? And I think this fails that test. So I'm going to give the patented 4/10. It's not the worst thing ever made. And I don't even know if it's the worst movie in this retrospective. That remains to be discussed. But not exactly hitting the bullseye right out of the gate for this character. Now, there was talk of a sequel going all the way back to 1990.
Yep.
They promoted The Punisher 2. New World did. But they went under and were subsequently bought out. So that's why it never materialized. But 15 years later, Lionsgate and Columbia would partner to bring us The Punisher 2004, making a real quote-unquote big screen debut, you know, slicked up. You got John Travolta as your villain. You got a post-X-Men type of surge for Marvel as a brand on screen. But much like this movie, kind of came and went because it didn't do gangbusters at the box office, and that also had a planned sequel that was canceled. So why did all that happen? First, we have to answer the question, Garrett, did you see The Punisher 2004 in theaters, and what are your expectations going into it for next week's show?
I did not see it in theaters. I ended up renting it when it showed up. Either, I don't even know if video stores were around, still around at this time. Maybe they were. Yeah, this was a rental for me. I brought it home, and I believe I watched it with my brother. And that was literally the last time I watched it. It was a one and done for me. I watched it one time. I was good. Me and my brother got a real big kick out of seeing Kevin Nash in it. I do remember the response we had to that. but that's literally all I really remember is Kevin Nash being a blonde and Thomas Jane mumbling through this character.
And John Travolta's overacting.
Well, yeah, we'll get there.
At least from my memory. Adam, what about you? Because I have something I need to say when you're done.
Never seen it. I do remember the pictures of Kevin Nash, and that almost, I mean, those popped me enough to almost do it. I'll spoil it now. I've never seen any of these. I never got through the Punisher TV show, but I did like him with Daredevil in those episodes. So no, this will be a first time watch for me. I've heard that Thomas Jane does a good job, quote unquote. And I do, from what I've seen a bit, I'm looking forward to this one at least a bit because it feels like they get it a little more right.
I had a visceral, anger-inducing experience the first time I watched this movie.
Oh, these are my favorite reviews.
I was so mad walking out of that. I was an 11-year-old kid walking out of that theater, and I walked out of that movie the way people walked out of Ang Lee's Hulk, just angry and pissed. It was literally Hulk smash. That's how I felt walking out of The Punisher. I mean, it was amazing that my mom even took me to go see this because I was 11 years old and this was a hard R. But she saw the Marvel logo, and like parents nowadays, they think, oh, that means family entertainment.
Wonderful.
That was not the case. I have always had a seething hatred for this movie, to the point where I have not watched it in damn near 15 years. I rewatched it when Warzone was coming out, and my thoughts were still the same. But since then, I've read a lot of Punisher comics, including the material that was used as inspiration for the movie. I'm curious to go back and watch it, because not only have we had multiple Punishers since then, Thomas Jane technically reprised the role in a short film.
What?
Hmm?
You don't know about this? That.
No, I had no idea.
All right, well, we'll talk about that next week. He reprised the role in a short called Dirty Laundry.
Oh, jeez.
That was in 2012. So, yeah, I mean, it's a movie that I don't want to say it's been forgotten about because people know its existence, but it's kind of a black sheep when you look at all the successes they were having with Blade and X-Men and Spider-Man. This did not have that same effect for various reasons, which I can't wait to get into. So until next week, we'll review The Punisher 2004, which, by the way, also thank God they didn't call Warzone The Punisher 2008, because I would have flipped shit. But until next week, when we review Punisher 2004, who punishes the podcasters?
You're leaving.
I have work to do. Read your newspaper every day, you'll understand.
Which section?
Obituaries.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Frankie his ass, huh? He's fine. He's all right.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Let me help you.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Don't let your memories kill you.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You have the right to shut the fuck up!
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advanced look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
Take that message to your people.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, Star Wars, the Pirates of the Caribbean film series, Indiana Jones, films of the DC universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Mission Impossible film series, the Predator films, the Lethal Weapon films, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Incredibles films, Avatar, and so much more.
You want to come along? Leave your badge at home.
Give me a hand, fellas.
Yeah.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
He hasn't slept all week.
How do you know?
Because I haven't slept all week.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I'm in charge of the body count.
Scheduling done by Matt.
Okay, enough of the jokes. Let's break out the champagne.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Why do you do this?
Somebody has to punish the corrupt.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
No more distractions. We need to focus on my goals.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
I still talk to God sometimes. I ask him if what I'm doing is right or wrong. I'm still waiting for an answer. And until I get one, I'll be out here, waiting, watching. The guilty will be punished.
Get out.
Adam gets to talk about comics again. I bet he's excited.
Oh, yeah, with this masterpiece.
You know what this was, Adam? This was, maybe I'll save it for this show.
All right, speaking of things I don't get.
Okay. Oh, see, God damn. Can I make a pussy joke? Hang on.
Okay. All right, oh, wait,
no, that was Predator. Boy,
yeah. Had a big... Yeah, that was Predator.
Sorry, there was an echo. When does that...
Okay. All right. Give me a countdown and we'll get this shindig going.
All right.
Let's get punished. You got to admit, though, Lou Gossett Jr. had an easier time acting next to a shark than he did Dolph Lundgren.
Listen, nephew.
So we left. and we also get. So until next week, we'll review The Punisher 2004, which, by the way, also thank God they didn't call Warzone The Punisher 2008, because I would have flipped shit. But until next week, when we review